This is an interview with Daniel L. Preston, an early member of Melbourne E. Hurl Post, the American Legion. This interview was made June 4th, 1985, by John Jenkins at One Riverside, Moorhead. Dan, when did you first come to Moorhead?
In January 1919, after I had been in the Army, and previous to my going to the Army, I had made arrangements with Dr. Frank Weld to be the chairman of the music department at the normal school. And then I went into the Army, and that arrangement, of course, was canceled out. But on shortly after November 11, when we learned that the war was over and that if we could find jobs, we could be mustered out at once. And when I found that out, I wired Dr. Weld to find out if he could use me. Fortunately, he had filled my vacancy with a lady whose husband was in the Army. And when she came to the armistice, she just quit and left the normal school a vacancy in music. And so I had a wire from Dr. Weld saying report on January 7th. And so without trying to adorn myself with civilian clothes, I was here on January 7th, and my work began.
When did you go into the service?
In May in 1918.
Mm-hmm. Where had you grown up? Where was your home?
I was born and raised at a little town of Bangor in Wisconsin, settled by the Welch. Mm-hmm. And my father had a barber shop, and I began my service to the community as a shoe shiner in the barber shop, which I kept until I went away to college. And then I went to Lawrence College in 1914 and completed my work in 1918. And at that time, I interviewed with Dr. Weld and had my assignment made, but I had to leave for the Army right away. And so I was in only from May until December, when I was mustered out. It's hard for me to keep this chronologically in order, but let me see. That was my first commitment to teaching was at the normal school in January 1919. There were then about 250 students and very, very few boys. By 1928, enough of the men had come back from the service so that we began asking about, inviting the men to sing in the college choir along with the girls.
First experience with American Legion then must have been in that period when you first came back.
Right, at the time when the local post was organized, I became a member.
Okay, then you were a charter member of
yes,
the right. Post. Do you remember some of the people who were instrumental in bringing together the
Recall Les Welter had a lot to do with it, mm-hmm. and George Comstock.
Mm-hmm. I believe he was the first commander, if I recall.
And Otto Bystrom.
Otto Bystrom, I remember him.
And Let me see. There was a couple of brothers by the name of Lun. I don't recall their first name.
Where was the post meeting, or where did they meet in the early years?
They, I just can't recall that now. I think it was at the Tecumseh Hotel, I'm not sure.
There was a time that I have heard about that they met up above, was it the Harris Brothers machine shop or something like that?
I think so.
That the, at one time they met there. What activities was the post involved in
well,
those early years?
Well, at that time, mostly they were concerned with observing the military connection with days like Memorial Day and other national holidays that needed to have some official leaders of a parade or whatever.
You were talking about the parades.
And they were always available for the firing squad at funerals. And actually, I never served on any committees, so I am not acquainted with the usual procedures that a committee goes through and the projects that they have in mind. But I was part of the membership.
Were there going on through the years in through the 20s then and into the 30s, did the Legion seem to change any at all? Was there a difference in the...
I don't recall any particular change in attitudes at all. After 1941, when we were back in the war again, I was not active. I had a welfare problem. I mean, not a welfare, but a physically bad setup. I had been bitten by a wood tick, and it gave me Rocky Mountain fever, so I was from 1941 to 48, I was semi-crippled with the result of that fever, which lasted from June till August. It was a very upsetting situation because the fatality rate of Rocky Mountain fever was very high. I don't recall just, but it was in the 90%, so we were hoping from day to day that I would get back on my feet. And one thing, I was so shrunken by that fever, having had it all summer, that I dropped my weight from 218 to 147. And the muscles on my back and shoulders and legs were all so stiff I couldn't dress myself. I had to have help. And so Don Pete, who was a county agent, was very kind and invited me to join with him in raising some onions. So he seeded the onions. And the idea was if I could get on my hands and knees and crawl around in the sunshine and work in the onion field, that I could restore a little flexibility of my muscles. And that's what really happened. We had 5 acres of onions, and my children and I did all the weeding. And by fall, I had regained my strength and could lift a 100-pound sack of onions into a wagon without any trouble. So, but following that experience, I was had lost contact with the my relationship to the Legion, and it never was, never did become alive again.
I'd like to go back to the time now. You came out of college and went into the service, and obviously it toward the tail end of the war. But I'd like to go back to that particular period and get your recall what you did in that in the relatively brief period that you were in the service.
Well, I was being trained with the rest of the battalion for service in French balloons as teletype operators, observation balloons they were. And the Germans had devastated the balloon reserves for the French, and that is their personnel, and so they were training American men for service in those balloons, but because of personnel reasons.
Where were you trained?
At the University of Wisconsin. But halfway through that, influenza became such a problem that they transferred me and two other men into the hospital corps as orderlies. And that's where I was at the end of the war. And we had, on the average, of 500 cases of double pneumonia to deal with. So there were many deaths. Every night we carried out a few bodies, and that was my war experience. I saw lots of anguish and death, but not in combat. I didn't get overseas.
No. And that was Rath University or somewhere near Madison?
Any movement of the battalion or something like Saturday morning inspections was held in the athletic field at the university. Otherwise, we were our classes met in the science building.
And then, after the armistice was signed, where were you when the armistice was signed?
I was in Madison then.
Do you remember it?
Oh, yes, I do. We had parades all over the place, all night long. It was quite a celebration, and I remember my wife telling about the celebration back in my little hometown. We had one child and was just an infant, and she says all the ladies in town who had babies put them in their buggies and led the parade down that little street.
And then after the armistice, that particular, your battalion was broken up.
Oh, yes. I never saw any of the men after that. I never knew where they were. We had been marched down to the train three different nights and then brought back again. And that was the third time that the morning after the third trip to the train, when I was transferred to the hospital as an orderly, and when I went back for my gear for the next morning, the battalion had pulled out that night. So I think maybe there was some another reason for my transfer to the hospital, and that was they didn't want to send a married man with a child overseas. So they had need for orderlies, and they took two others on the same with the same problem.
When you came to Moorhead, then you came from right from Madison?
No, I had been. I came home for Christmas in Bangor, where my parents lived, and then in January immediately following, I came out here. My wife was waited at my the home of my parents until spring. But I remember when I got off that MP train that morning and could see no hills, I wrote my wife and said, if I can ever stand this place until spring, I'll be lucky. Because back there we had nothing but hills. And it was all 16 miles back from the Mississippi River, and you know what high bluffs there are along the Mississippi River. Well, that extended back into the state, maybe 16 miles or more before it began to level out. And then not too far from that, it was a place where the ice age never affected it. All the erosion there around Camp Douglas was by wind. There was no lakes or that I ever remember of. It was just big pillars of rock that had been blown away, the wind reduced their size, and you could see layer upon layer of what had been deposited by water in the centuries past.
Yeah, that is a glacial free area, down near Winona, yeah. And that area of Minnesota also. I suspect that in those years, Morehead Normal was pretty much out in the flat country also.
Oh, yes, there were. It was butted on a farm, Comstock and Wheeler Hall were right next to farmland.
And that continued for quite a while, actually,
yes,
until after into the 1940s, late 1940s, before they began to change that.
It remained that way for a long time, and before the campus began to spread out. And
where did you first live when you came in January?
I lived in a small house just a half a block west of the old high school building on 8th Street. And previous to that, when I was here alone before my wife came, I lived in an upstairs apartment right next to the Congregational Church in a building which has long since been removed. When Dr. Weld came up to see where I was living, he says, we can't have you living in a place like this. And so he found another place for me, and I've forgotten now where that was. I think it was no, I don't remember.
Your work in those years, you were the, you had the music.
There was one other teacher there by the name of Bullard. She came from, what's this town to the west here of Fargo?
Castleton?
Castleton. Her home was Fargo. Otherwise, there were just Miss Bullard and myself, and I had to work with children in the first grade, teach them about music, how to sing and how to read. And I had a girls' choir in the college. I taught sight singing and ear training to all students. It was required of boys and girls. At that time, I still carried with me a kind of a resistance to anyone who was a sergeant. And so when I met all of those students for the first sing-along between chapel and the sing-along, I remember there were two girls knitting mittens sitting in the front row. And I told them, I said, the war is over, girls, so why don't you put your mittens away and sing? Well, they did. But the next day they got their mittens out again, began knitting again. So I said, well, if you don't want to sing, why don't you take your mittens and go over to President Wells' office and knit? That's a good place. They left. I don't know where they went. But I went over to talk with the president about what kind of discipline I should employ. And he says, well, if they're there to sing, make them sing or tell them to get out. And that's what we did. I recall, though, that between the singing period and the chapel, which was always begun by a reading of scripture and a hymn, girls would play that piano in the interim between the singing period and the chapel, but I didn't know who got those girls to play. I had nothing to do with it. Well, the next fall, there were no girls to play the piano, and President Weld called me in. He says, why aren't there girls playing the piano? Oh, I said to him, was that my responsibility? Well, it's music, isn't it? He says, it is your responsibility. Well, I said, if you think I'm going to hang around the girls' dormitory to find out who plays the piano, you're mistaken. And I said, I slammed the door and went out, and in a half hour, he came over to tell me to forget about taking the girls for music. He says, well, get the dean of women to do it. And so he was that kind of a fellow. He was right down to earth, and I think very, very honest with his teachers. If he gave them a job to do, he connected with them and worked with them. But he also had an understanding of any change in structure of the program, so that he was aware then that he had never told me that it was a special assignment of someone to select those girls to make the interim music.
What was it like in Moorhead in those years? What activities were going on?
The streets were not paved. The milkman got stuck in front of our house on 10th Street in the mud. And I don't know about the town. I don't recall. All I know that in the residence district there were no paved streets. And I lived at on 10th Street, right? I think it's a Lutheran students building.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. I live right next to that building. And there my family grew up. I had five children. Jane was the oldest, Bill the youngest, and that's where we lived until Bill was through the grade school. All of our children went to the campus elementary school.
And it was also a high school.
And the high school, and well, except Bill didn't go to high school there. He went to Moorhead High School and played football and stuff like that. But Jim and Molly both graduated from Moorhead State with their major in music. Jim first began teaching in Audubon after he got out of 3 years in the Army overseas in the Mediterranean area. He was an office help, not in combat unit. And Molly finished her 4 years with the music, but she never taught. She married Claire Flood, who was one of Sliv Nemzik's soldiers, and so she never did get to teach, but traveled around the country with her husband, wherever he was stationed, Hawaii, Japan, Vienna, Fort Bliss in El Paso,
Texas.
And then when they got out, they lived at Cape Canaveral until they moved back to Hawaii. They're now living there in just a town next to Honolulu, Waianae.
Are there other particular memories you have in particular the period of the 20s in Morehead and a connection with the Legion or with other activities in the community?
I don't recall that there was any great activity in the community during those years. It was not until the bank holiday in 1929 that a big change came over the attitude of our society, because no one had any funds to deal with. On a Friday I received my check and put it in the bank, and on Monday I had no money at all, and everybody else was in the same predicament. And it seemed to me that working together as a group became easier for people. Now in the Amphion Chorus, which had 125 men in it, we never had absenteeism. They were there. It wasn't until prosperity returned again that another war developed, and we had some problems all over again.
I'd like you to recall, if you could, some of the early people that came back out of the service during those early years, some of them that came back to college, or to the normal, I'm sure.
The first men to come back were Bill Curran, John and Dewey Gates, and Paul Berquist, Terry Sharp, and that's all I can recall. Right, that there were about 12 that came back along that time, and Nemzik was a football coach, and maybe it wasn't there yet, but they had such few men for the team that Archer and I of the faculty put on football suits and went out to play on the second team so that he would have enough for two teams. And I remember how tickled these college boys were to dump Archer and me over on our heads in contact.
And most of those fellows that came back then from the service also went to normal.
Yeah, they were. I'm not sure. No, I don't think so. I think they didn't return until after the 4-year course started. I don't remember enough men in a normal school to have had any kind of an athletic team at all of any kind.
And that started in 1926, I think, wasn't it?
I think it became a university earlier than that, about 1923. It's about that time.
Okay, well, that's good.